This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
For Friday, May 26, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado. British Prime Minister Tony Blair is in Washington, where he meets with President Bush. We'll hear from Oaxaca City, where human rights defenders protest against femicide. And as Colombian voters set to go to the polls Sunday, we'll take a look at the candidates. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Monica Lopez with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Senate has voted 78-15 to confirm General Michael Hayden as the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Hayden previously oversaw the National Security Agency at the beginning of its massive domestic spying program. The appointment marks the first time in a quarter of a century that a military figure will head the CIA. In an attempt to ease tensions in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Hamas-led government ordered its special forces off Gaza streets in the wake of clashes with the Fatah movement, which has stirred fears of civil war. Manar Jabrin reports.
Friday's order came a day after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas gave Hamas a 10-day ultimatum to either back a proposal for statehood that implicitly recognizes Israel or face a referendum on the issue. Clashes between Hamas and Fatah have become more frequent since last week's deployment of a new security force consisting of 3,000 Hamas loyalists. Clashes between the newly formed force and the security forces under the control of the president have killed 10 people and injured several others. Despite the calls from President Abbas to disband this force, Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh said on Thursday that the Palestinian government is set to complete in the coming weeks the process of integrating the new force into the existing Palestinian police. For FSRN from imemc.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Peacekeeping forces from New Zealand will soon join their Australian counterparts in the tiny island nation of East Timor. Tensions have been escalating there since 600 Timorese soldiers were dismissed after protesting discrimination within the ranks. Groups of former soldiers formed a rebel faction and began launching attacks on pro-government troops and police. At least 20 have been killed and several thousand have been displaced by the fighting. Australian peacekeepers arrived in the Timorese capital yesterday to de-escalate the situation. East Timor's Foreign Minister José Ramos Horta has indicated the possibility of peace talks between rival groups as early as this weekend. In Nepal, the government began peace talks with Maoist rebels today. Maoists entered into an alliance with the country's seven political parties when King Gyanendra still held absolute power. Observers and government negotiators seem confident of a breakthrough. Heavy fighting in Afghanistan continues. Reuters reports that at least five people were killed in a clash between Taliban militants and Afghan police. Fighting in Afghanistan has killed some 300 people since last week in what has been described as the worst violence since the 2001 invasion. Anti-war protesters have been arrested in Olympia, Washington, as they try to block U.S. Army convoys headed for Iraq. Mark Taylor Canfield reports.
Equipment for the 3rd Striker Brigade, headquartered at Fort Lewis, is being loaded onto ships at the Port of Olympia as troops prepare to leave for Iraq on their second deployment. Anti-war protesters have continued to commit acts of civil disobedience in an attempt to block the military vehicles' access to port facilities. Demonstrators say they oppose the use of the public port to support what they call an illegal and immoral war. Their repeated attempts to force the Port Commission to stop accepting military shipments since 2004 have been unsuccessful. The military convoys are scheduled to continue for another week, and protesters say they'll be back for more demonstrations. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
The South Central farmers and their supporters continue their encampment on the nation's largest urban farm. After increased pressure from local and international media, L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa finally commented on the farm, saying that current landowner Ralph Horowitz should bring the $16 million selling price down closer to the roughly $5 million he paid for it 2 years ago. As people inside the farm gathered past midnight to strategize for a possible eviction and arrests, supporter Daryl Hanna spoke to Free Speech Radio News.
Everybody who's here, you know, especially who's staying here, has to be ready for that because it is civil disobedience and everyone really has to know what to do in that case. And so I think it's right for everyone to be prepared. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. Hopefully it won't. We're really working hard to try to find some way to have a resolution and to really save this place and not have to be evicted for it to all end up where everybody's happy.
And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Monica Lopez.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair is in Washington today, where he met with President Bush at the White House. Both acknowledged that the war in Iraq is not proceeding as smoothly as they had hoped and admitted regret for incidents like the prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib. During his visit, Tony Blair called for UN reform and stressed the need for enhanced multilateralism. FSRN's Anastasia Genetsditska reports from Washington, D.C.
When talking about the issue of Iraq, which was the key on their agenda, both Bush and Blair stated again that they are not outlining any specific timetable for withdrawal from Iraq.
It's hard to have a command and control system with an Iraqi army when you don't have a defense minister. And so Mr. Maliki's going to have to pick one soon. And then our commanders will gauge as to whether or not the command and control structure is sufficient to be able to enable the Iraqis to take more of the fight.
Tony Blair, however, sounded more optimistic about the possibility of imminent pullout.
I think it's possible for the Iraqi security forces to take control progressively of their country. That's exactly the strategy we've outlined at the beginning. And I think it's possible to happen in the way that Prime Minister Maliki said.
Both Tony Blair and George Bush face low approval ratings in their countries. That's why both of them stress the issues that are important domestically. In particular, Tony Blair addressed the need for reform of the United Nations as a way of reviving effective multilateralism in international affairs, a call that would likely be popular with his constituency at home.
Prime Minister, you've both talked a little about the UN. I know that you believe the UN needs vigorous leadership. Is that a job application? And if not,
wait a minute.
Do you both have a sense? Do you have someone in mind? And if not, how are you going to get the reform of the UN you want to see?
No, I'm not sure. The answer that what we want to do is to make sure that the UN is an effective instrument of multilateral action. The fact is there are multiple problems in the world. They require the international community to respond on a collective basis, but you've got to have an effective set of multilateral institutions to do that. And that's true whether you're tackling global poverty or dealing with issues like Iran.
The current White House, despite the close relationship between Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair, remains wary of getting entangled in what it would see as too much multilateralism. Victoria Sampson, research analyst at the Center for Defense Information.
Multilateralism would be great. However, I really think Prime Minister Blair was playing to the British audiences in regards to that. There's so much hostility towards the United States for its perceived unilateralism over the past 5 years that I think it's his way of doing a course correction. Tony Blair has been very heavily criticized by people domestically and abroad for the British insistence on sticking with the United States with our policy in Iraq, come hell or high water. And it seems that what he's trying to do is trying to deflect some of that criticism and an attempt to try to say, well, even though the United States is insisting on doing things one way, we have our own policy and we're promoting a more multilateral approach.
That said, one aspect that both leaders agreed on was certain missteps in conducting the war in Iraq.
Saying bring it on, kind of tough talk, you know, that sent the wrong signal to people. I learned some lessons about expressing myself maybe in a little more sophisticated manner, wanted dead or alive, that kind of talk. I think in certain parts of the world it was misinterpreted. You know, I think the biggest mistake that's happened so far, at least from our country's involvement in Iraq, is Abu Ghraib. We've been paying for that for a long period of time.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
Germany's Foreign Intelligence Service, the BND, has been accused of spying on journalists. A leaked report commissioned by a parliamentary committee criticized the BND for overstepping its bounds by spying on the press and for using journalists to snitch on each other. Since the 1980s, the BND has spied on a number of major German news publications, but the BND says its actions were purely for self-protection. Cinnamon Apard reports from Berlin.
In 1993, editor of the news magazine Focus, Eric Schmidt-Ehrenboom, published a book about the BND which raised the ire of the agency. But General Secretary of the German Journalists Union, Ulrike Merx-Franzen, says he was not the only one placed under surveillance.
When we think about the fact that all colleagues and all persons who have been in contact with the one author, Schmidt-Ehrenboom, in the years 1993 to 1995, that all these persons have been surveilled by the BND, we have to speak about more than 90 persons.
When other newspapers reported on Schmidt-Ehrenboom's predicament, many of them were also placed under surveillance, often by other journalists enlisted by the BND. Lukas Wallruf is a journalist working for the newspaper Die Tageszeitung in their parliament office in Berlin.
Many journalists spied on their own colleagues, and there's a big gray zone also among the journalists, what is according to the journalistic ethos and what is not.
The BND defended its action, saying that it was trying to identify leaks to the press from its own department. Ulrike Merx-Franzen from the German Journalists Union.
They should have surveyed the telephones of their own employees, not those of journalists who could have been in contact with them. They damaged the freedom of press in result of a problem they had in their own office.
The German government has condemned the actions of its foreign intelligence service, banning them from using journalists in this manner. Former heads of the BND are waving accusatory fingers at each other, and so far politicians are also passing the buck on taking responsibility for this 25-year scandal. While two news publications, The Stern and Der Spiegel, are considering taking legal action. Journalist Lukas Wallruf.
The problem is that you will always have contacts between journalists and Secret Service people, and there probably will always be a gray zone of where the limits are, what is legal and what is illegal.
The report was made public in Berlin today. Among those who have welcomed its release is opposition Liberal Democrat lawmaker Max Stadler, vice chairman of the Parliament Supervisory Committee. He was speaking on German public radio.
The debate is certainly not over now that the Schäfer report is out, he says. We need to clear up why the government's control mechanisms vis-à-vis the BND's activities were so inefficient, and we have to be clear about measures needed to ensure that there will be no more infringements of the freedom of the press in future.
The German Foreign Intelligence Service has just celebrated its 50th anniversary of operation. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
Colombian voters head to the polls this Sunday for the country's presidential election. While the South American nation has stood out as the strongest Bush administration ally among a growing trend of leftist leaders in the region, Colombian President Álvaro Uribe remains ahead in the polls and will most likely win a second term. But the recent rise in popularity of leftist candidate Carlos Gaviria opens the possibility of a runoff. From Bogotá, Nicole Carson has more.
Last Sunday, thousands of supporters of the leftist candidate Carlos Gaviria filled Bogota's main plaza as the former senator and constitutional court judge closed his campaign. Unlike his rival President Álvaro Uribe, Gaviria, a candidate of the new non-traditional party called the Alternative Democratic Polo Party, recognizes the armed conflict plaguing the country, and instead of employing military force, he plans on using state institutions to attack the causes of the conflict. Unlike Uribe, Gaviria supports abortion rights and is deeply opposed to this nation's free trade agreement with the U.S. Carlos Gaviria.
My main work has been to contribute to the consolidation of a political alternative in Colombia, a program, a project very different from that of the president. If we win, my work from the presidency will be to consolidate this proposal. And if we lose, my work continues to be consolidating this proposal so that it will be a challenge for whatever authoritarian movement of the extreme right, like that of Dr. Uribe.
While President Uribe has remained ahead in the polls, some say a recent gain by Gaviria to 20% may cause a runoff. Based on the massive anti-Uribe mobilizations and roadblocks that seized southern Colombia during the past couple weeks, as well as the Constitutional Court's decision to overturn Uribe's peace and justice law for the paramilitaries that are demobilizing, some speculate that these events could bring a surprise on Election Day. However, analyst Alfredo Rangel says that this is the least violent electoral season in decades and that Gaviria's recent rise in popularity does not put Uribe's re-election at risk.
All the polls in Colombia that are done very scientifically coincide with the general tendencies that give Uribe a victory in the first round, and they place the other candidates very far away from Uribe.
Tension continues in southern Colombia, where thousands of indigenous peoples, Afro-Colombians, and farmers protested the re-election of Uribe and the free trade agreement. At least four people were killed in police repression since May 15th. Alfredo Acosta, the coordinator of 7,000 unarmed NASA Indigenous Guard in northern Cauca, says he will employ Indigenous Guards to ensure safety at the voting booths this Sunday.
We are against the politics of this government and against the re-election of a totalitarian government that fuels the war, an extremist government. To re-elect this government is to ratify a policy of war, of democratic security that has afflicted civilians, families, and that has promoted displacement. We reject their election and the policies of the current government.
However, yesterday the government announced that it will revoke voting booths from rural areas in southern Colombia. Daniel Garcia Peña, who is managing Gaviria's campaign, is extremely concerned.
That in many of these areas are exactly where the Polo Democratico has had important votes in recent elections. The marches that took place last week in Cauca and so forth. So these areas, the government is saying that there are security reasons to move the voting, away from the rural areas into the urban areas, into the cities, which obviously makes it very difficult for people in the countryside to come in and to vote, which is quite ironic because on one side the president is saying that the Seguridad Democrática has been able to pacify the country, but on the other hand, they are in fact alluding to security reasons in order to justify the moving of these voting places.
Another of what Garcia Peña calls dirty campaign tricks is a threatening letter sent around to NGOs and universities threatening Gaviria supporters. The letter reads, quote, "We will struggle with blood and fire against whoever opposes the interest that our legitimate leader continue the presidency," end quote. The letter is signed by a group that calls itself Colombia Free of Communists, armed group of the ex-AUC. While Garcia Peña says the threatening letter is worrisome, he has turned it over for authorities to investigate. Meanwhile, at least 10 universities have closed down until elections end because of the letter. From Bogota, this is Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
According to a recent report issued by Mexico's lower house of Congress, an average of 4 women or girls are killed daily in the country, mostly in the states of Mexico, Veracruz, Chiapas, Guerrero, and Mexico City, aside from Ciudad Juarez. The report indicates that Oaxaca takes second place for femicide. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City, where human rights defenders organized a protest demanding justice for the over 20 women that have been killed in the past 9 months alone.
Around a dozen civil organizations from Oaxaca presented the Federal Chamber of Deputies with media documentation of some cases of violence against women. Although the state and federal governments recognize the gravity of this situation, human rights organizations like Amnesty International say it appears that these crimes continue to go unpunished. Alin Castellanos, member of the women's rights group Colectivo Huaxyacac, comments on this situation.
El resultado de la investigación sobre feminicidios en la República Mexicana llevada a cabo por
The result of the investigation into the femicides in Mexico was carried out by the nation's Congress in 10 states in 2005. It concluded that yes, there is femicide in Oaxaca. The institution charged with enforcing the law and obtaining justice in Oaxaca are not carrying out the necessary steps to investigate, punish, and prevent violence against women. which in the course of 5 years, between 1999 and 2003, have totaled 352 homicides of women and girls.
The lack of sensitivity and adequate training of the Oaxacan authorities in charge of investigating femicide cases is one of the reasons why many women don't report incidents of aggression, which means very few cases are resolved. Adela Hernandez, whose 30-year-old sister disappeared last year, tells of her experience with the Office of the Special Prosecutor for Crimes Against Women in Oaxaca.
Mi hermana desaparece extrañamente desde el día 21 de agosto hasta la fecha. La procuraduría no me.
My sister strangely disappeared on August 21st. Up to the present day, the Office of the Special Prosecutor has not responded in any way to my case. I've received bad treatment, humiliation, because I am guilty of having a sister who is missing, of being a woman who is poor and solitary. It's cause for indignation that women in positions of power have shown much indifference towards cases as that of my sister and other women who have disappeared or have been killed by their husbands. So, it's a situation of despair.
Two 100 people, mostly women, marched yesterday afternoon through the streets of Oaxaca City to demand justice for murdered women, which, according to official figures, totaled over 50 in the past year. Also yesterday, the Office of the Special Prosecutor for Crimes Against Women in Oaxaca presented its first report. March participant Ana María Hernández comments.
Today, the special prosecutor gave figures regarding this problematic situation in Oaxaca and made assurances that in the last 16 months they received 26 complaints of gang rape, that almost 2 women are gang raped a month, every month.
Human rights organizations in Oaxaca will soon participate in work sessions with Amnesty International, and in the coming days will present documentation on the extent of violent crimes against women in Oaxaca. Oaxaca City, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
This is Will Dog Vozo Motley, and you're listening to Free Speech Radio News.
African governments have been accused of violating people's rights under the guise of promoting security. In their latest report, human rights watchdog Amnesty International says that although there were indications of progress in some parts of Africa, the situation has remained pathetic and that the international community and the UN are slow to act. Joshua Chilimpa reports from the Amnesty International Africa Region office in Kampala.
The report says that impunity by governments was widespread and that China and Russia stood in the way of action against the perpetrators of human rights abuses due to their economic interest on the African continent. Michel Kagari, the deputy director of Amnesty International Africa Program, says that the situation in Darfur is one in case where the international community has been slow to act.
Governments have collectively and individually paralyzed international institutions and squandered resources and capacity in misguided military and security strategies. Darfur is the saddest case in point in 2005. 2 million people have been displaced, over 200,000 have died, and 1,000 others have been raped, and the atrocities continue unabated. Intermittent attention and feeble action by the United Nations and the African Union fell pathetically short of what was needed in Darfur. China and Russia paralyzed the UN Security Council to protect their oil interests and arms trade with Khartoum over human rights and responsibilities domestically and internationally.
Amnesty International says that they have a team in Central African nation of Chad to ensure that the war in Darfur does not spread to Chad. They are asking the UN to ignore protests from Sudan against the proposed UN deployment. Of the progress that has been made, Amnesty International representatives say they are happy to report that former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor, was transferred to the UN court in Sierra Leone, that Charles Lubanga, leader of the militia in Congo, was also transferred to The Hague to answer to cases related to war crimes, and the leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army operating in northern Uganda were indicted for war crimes. The Human Rights Organization also wants the impunity enjoyed by governments to end. The chairperson of the Eastern Horn of Africa Human Rights Defenders, Mr. Hassan Shah Sheikh, says the torture by governments in Africa does not bring about peace.
It has been proved in the world that torture, that's why we had a convention banning it, will never contribute any substantive stability to the criminal's mind about what they intend to do. But proper intelligence, proper investigation matter, and proper resource devoted to that and collaborations among the governments of the world could also mitigate about those kinds of activities. But torture in any way will never have any contribution to the upheldment of the rule of law. I advise governments of the world to be true to what they have signed, to be true to their domestic laws, and to be true to the international conventions to which they are subscribed to. There's no way going back of this achievement, and deploying a civilized way of upholding the rule of law will ultimately serve the justice and security for all.
At the launch of the Amnesty International report on Wednesday, Mcheru Kagali had this final word to the UN and the international community.
The killings, rape and displacement in Darfur must stop. The Darfur Peace Agreement contains strong human rights provisions that offer a way ahead, if properly implemented. But for it to work, the UN Security Council must urgently deploy UN peacekeepers and must not allow itself to be manipulated by Sudan. Pending their deployment, the African monitors must be supported by the international community to carry out their work. There is a particular responsibility on the Arab states to encourage Sudan to concede to a UN operation. Arab leaders do a disservice to themselves and their people when they use solidarity as a shield to avoid their human rights responsibilities. More than ever, the world needs countries with powers and influence to behave with responsibility and respect for human rights. Governments must stop playing games with human rights.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
And that will do it for today's newscast. Join us this Monday, Memorial Day, as Free Speech Radio News brings you a special documentary in memoriam produced by Ankayala Kelly.
United States Marines illegally landed their troops on January 16, 1893, in an attempt to annex Hawaii by installing a puppet government.
We are still bitter over how they treated our queen, imprisoned her, and how they took over our government.
The Hawaiians of the 19th century, early 20th century, any of the ones that had anything to do with trying to resist or stop the United States taking Hawaii against their will, they're not resting in peace. We feel their presence all the time.
I'm a genealogical descendant of the first people that walked these islands, and I think it's important for every generation that we remind them that they too are descended. It gives us a very special relationship to the Aina, Aina meaning land.
A native burial is always a target of militarization expansion, of hotel expansion for the tourists. So even you as a Hawaiian, you can get evicted as Hawaiian even when you pass on. We're always at the threat of being evicted from our homelands, even when we're under the ground.
That's this Monday, a special documentary in memoriam on FSRN. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can find archives of this newscast or any other newscast or documentary online at fsrn.org. You can also email us your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Ada Bogado.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news.
I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, George Bush cheered the new government in Iraq as a turning point in the struggle between freedom and terror. But the White House's optimistic view of Iraq is meeting with some media resistance, even in mainstream outlets. Independent journalist Aaron Glantz will join us to talk about the coverage and the situation in Iraq. Also on the program, with some of the people making anti-immigration arguments these days, it's pretty clear their position rests on fear or plain old prejudice. But what about people who say they only oppose immigration because of the negative impact it has on struggling U.S. workers? We'll hear from Doug Henwood of the Left Business Observer on the economic side of the immigration debate. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press.
The country's big daily newspapers naturally carried reports on Michael Hayden's Senate confirmation hearing to become the next head of the CIA. The preeminent concerns surrounding Hayden, of course, have to do with the highly controversial warrantless wiretapping program carried out by the National Security Agency while he was in charge. Nevertheless, as far as we could tell, the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times all managed to cover the hearings without asking the basic question of whether that program was legal. The New York Times headline demonstrated the favored superficial approach. Nominee says NSA stayed within law on wiretaps. What's so strange here is that all of these papers have run stories or op-eds citing legal scholars who strongly challenge the White House's justifications. It's frankly not that easy to find legal experts to argue that the wiretapping program was totally within the law. Yet on the day that the architect of the plan gets up and testifies in the Senate, somehow these papers couldn't bring themselves to call on those sources. Perhaps the best effort was a phrase in the Post indicating that some legal scholars have challenged the program's constitutionality. But when we're talking about protecting citizens' basic civil liberties, that's just not effort enough.
It's a safe bet that for most people, the new Medicare prescription drug benefit Plan D is pretty hard to understand. Scores of reports have shown how difficult it's been for seniors just to sign up for the program, and the terrible problems faced by participants and pharmacists have been well documented. It's no surprise, then, that politicians might seek to benefit from the mess. A May 23rd New York Times article tried to show how that was happening, but in the end offered another example of the lamentable media trend called false balance. Under the headline, In Medicare Debate, Massaging the Facts, reporter Robert Pear set out to show how both parties were spinning the program to their benefit. The Bush White House has issued seriously misleading press releases about enrollment in the plan, and Pear clearly demonstrates how they're playing with the numbers. But readers are told early on that, quote, Democrats stretch the facts too, close quote. That's not hard to believe. These are politicians, after all. But Pear offers no evidence to support the claim. Instead, we learn that Democrats are saying that private insurers have made a mess of the program, that the, quote, administration mismanaged its rollout, unquote, that a massive gap in coverage under some plans will be a rude awakening, and that some Democrats say the law was written by special interests like the pharmaceutical industry. If any of that is factually untrue, the Times doesn't say so. If anything, these are criticisms, and fairly reasonable ones, of a much criticized government program. Party politics aside, it's a bad day for journalism when a story like that can't simply be told like it is.
The sale of Philadelphia's two hometown newspapers, The Inquirer and The Daily News, to a group of local businessmen means the formerly Knight Ridder-owned dailies will no longer be subject to Wall Street pressure. But that may be the only good news in the deal for Philadelphians. As former Inquirer editor Robert Rosenthal told editor and publisher, the new owners include, quote, some of the most influential business people in Philadelphia and people who actively support politicians locally and nationally. I don't think there is a situation like this in the country where the ownership group is so much a part of the political and economic power structure of a city, close quote. Upon announcement of the sale, the new owners pledged not to interfere with the editorial independence of the newspapers, but concerns persist. For instance, lead investor Bruce Toll is a major local car dealer and real estate developer, two industries famous for pressuring local newspapers with their advertising dollars. Toll, who will serve as chairman of the new ownership group, Philadelphia Media Holdings, has been frequently mentioned in the two papers in recent years. Another lead investor, Brian Tierney, is the former national head of the Catholics for Bush campaign and has donated more than $200,000 to Republican causes in recent years. Perhaps more disturbingly, as a representative of the Philadelphia Archdiocese, Tierney once battled with Inquirer reporter Ralph Cipriano over a story about the Archdiocese. Cipriano, who lost his job over the tussle and subsequently won a libel suit against the paper, told The Times, quote, "For an advocate kicking down editors' doors, I don't think he showed much respect for the integrity of the newsroom." Close quote. It remains to be seen if the new owner's non-interference pledge means anything, but it seems many aren't holding out much hope.
On May 21st, U.S.-led forces bombed a school and homes in an Afghan village, leaving dozens dead and dozens more wounded. An Associated Press report on the incident the next day noted that the U.S. claimed that it had confirmed 20 Taliban killed in the attack, with up to 60 more possible Taliban casualties, but that local sources claimed at least 16 civilians were also killed and many others wounded. The headlines at many news outlets that day reflected the heavy civilian casualties. The Toronto Globe and Mail even headlined their report on the incident, "Bombs Kill Afghan Villagers. Aerial attack makes Canadian mission to win local support much more difficult." But the AP ran their report under the headline, "Up to 80 Taliban dead in U.S.-led strike," ignoring the civilian casualties and the strong uncertainties expressed in their own article about the U.S. body count and portraying the attack as a glowing military success. Given the fact that a lot of readers only skim the headlines, U.S. military officials couldn't have asked for a better spin.
And finally, given George W. Bush's falling popularity, you can't blame Fox News for looking for a new formula to replace its traditional White House cheerleading. But is the next big thing for Fox going to be white supremacy? Take a recent rant from Bill O'Reilly. On his May 17th show, O'Reilly warned of an anti-white, anti-Christian conspiracy led by the New York Times. Quote, "The newspaper and many far-left thinkers believe the white power structure that controls America is bad, so a drastic change is needed. According to the lefty zealots, the white Christians who hold power must be swept out by a new multicultural tide." Close quote. According to O'Reilly, the Times and many others on the left want, quote, "the legalization of millions of Hispanic illegal aliens," close quote, in order to accomplish this. Just for the record, the lefty zealots at the New York Times endorsed white Republican Rudolph Giuliani over black Democrat David Dinkins for mayor of New York City, and white Republican Michael Bloomberg over Latino Democrat Fernando Ferrer. That's a pretty odd way to go about bringing down the white power structure. O'Reilly isn't the only one pushing the white people under threat idea. On May 11th, Fox's John Gibson told his viewers to do your duty, make more babies. His explanation was a new report indicating that half of the children under five in the U.S. are minorities. Said Gibson, quote, "By far, the greatest number are Hispanic. You know what that means? 25 years and the majority of the population is Hispanic," close quote. Actually, Latinos are projected to be 20% of the U.S. population in 2030, but then facts don't have much to do with the sort of fears O'Reilly and Gibson are selling. Gibson has vehemently and repeatedly denied any racist implications in his remarks, at one point declaring, quote, "a browner America doesn't bother me in the slightest," close quote. On May 16th, Gibson explained it this way, quote, "my concern was simply that I didn't want America to become Europe, where the birth rate is so low, the continent is fast being populated by immigrants, mainly from Muslim countries, whose birth rate is very high," close quote. Good thing he cleared that up.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
In a May 22nd speech in Chicago, George W. Bush hailed the formation of a new Iraqi government, announcing, quote, "we have now reached a turning point in the struggle between freedom and terror," close quote. Bush acknowledged how unpopular the war is, but his overall tone differed little from earlier occasions when he'd cheered other turning points, including Iraqi elections and the alleged transfer of sovereignty. What seemed to change, at least a little, was media willingness to accept Bush's optimistic view of Iraq. For instance, a front-page New York Times report just 2 days after the Bush speech was headlined, "In Shadows, Armed Groups Propel Iraq Toward Chaos." That article was one of a growing number of dire mainstream reports that have begun to resemble stories reported by progressive and independent journalists since the occupation began 3 years ago. Joining us now is Aaron Glantz. He's an independent journalist who has reported extensively from occupied Iraq. He is also the author of the new book, How America Lost Iraq. Glantz joins us now by phone from California. Aaron Glantz, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Well, we're seeing more pessimism in American reporting about Iraq. A report in the Atlantic Monthly last December by Nir Rosen, for instance, described the situation there as so dire that the author called for a U.S. withdrawal, arguing that the feared civil war that the U.S. was there to prevent was underway and that the U.S. presence was actually creating more violence than it was preventing. What's surprising about that is that The Atlantic is not exactly an anti-war publication. Aaron Glantz, how do you see the situation in Iraq currently?
Well, the violence is escalating and the lack of basic services that's been present since the beginning of the occupation continues. I was on the phone yesterday to Basra talking to the head of the oil workers union there, and he was telling me that the amount of electricity in Basra, which used to be considered a success story, is down from about 3 hours a day. Now people in Basra have electricity for only 30 minutes to an hour a day. You also have 14,000 people incarcerated without trial at Abu Ghraib and other prisons, and many of those folks are innocent. And, of course, all of those folks are being held not by the Iraqi government, but by the U.S. military. You have a breakdown of society over time. The mainstream media talks about the formation of militias. They leave out sometimes the context of this. You have 3 years of a lack of basic services, clean water, electricity, security, 3 years of 70% unemployment, 3 years of people pulling their children in and out of school because they're afraid that they might get bombed on their way to school, and they can't call the police. They can't call the police because the police are tied into an unpopular foreign occupation. They can't call the military because the military gets its orders from the U.S. military, which is increasingly unpopular. So in this kind of atmosphere, people form neighborhood militias to protect themselves. And sometimes, and increasingly so, these militias are fighting each other. And sometimes, and increasingly so, these militias are backed by fundamentalists. And sometimes the U.S. military is working with these fundamentalists.
So all of these factors put together doesn't bode well for the U.S.'s hearts and minds campaign, if you will.
The thing that Bush has it wrong when he says we have to stay the course in order to make sure that Iraq doesn't get worse is he misses the point that we have become the center of the violence. When I was in Iraq, I met an auto mechanic in Adamiya, a Sunni section of Baghdad, and I said, okay, Mr. Auto Mechanic, you're in the insurgency. You're in the resistance. What do you do? He said, well, every day me and my friends get together at a cafe. We drink tea. We smoke cigarettes. And when the American patrol comes through, we hit it. And if no American patrol comes through, then we bomb the police station because they're collaborators. Now, the Iraqi political class has tried to get around this by participating in the elections that we organized. And the Sunni political parties, the Iraqi Islamic Party, for example, participate in the elections and won the seat as one of Iraq's vice presidents. Well, today, Tariq al-Hashemi, the vice president, said that he is wanting the U.S. military and the British military out in a matter of months. The prime minister of Iraq, elected Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, says that the Iraqis can take over the entire country in 18 months, and everything but Anbar and Baghdad by the end of the year. George Bush and Tony Blair are ignoring them. So then you have these people like this auto mechanic who attacks the police because he sees them as a tool of the occupation. Well, this will go on as long as the elected Iraqi government is roundly ignored by Washington.
FAIR recently published a media advisory about how New York Times columnist Tom Friedman has been making the same claim that the next 6 months in Iraq will be decisive for the past 2.5 years. Now, in the past, this sort of resetting the clock for measuring success in Iraq has served the White House well. But we seem to be seeing more pessimism about Iraq in the press these days. Do you sense any difference in the recent coverage?
Well, I was watching George Bush's speech on CNN, the one you were talking about in the beginning. And in the middle of his speech, the CNN editor must have gotten bored because they just cut away from it and they stopped broadcasting it. Because I think increasingly people in this country realize that he is disconnected from reality, including news organizations. The problem is they didn't then go to a critical voice, somebody who actually knew what was going on. They just moved on to cover a different subject. And this is a problem, and you mentioned that I wrote a book, and I've been traveling around talking to folks on my book tour, and one thing that I interact with is that a lot of people are increasingly skeptical about what the Bush administration is claiming. They know that something is very wrong, but they don't have a lot of information about why things are wrong, and they don't have a lot of information about what the U.S. role is in all of this.
Aaron Glantz, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you finally, as somebody with experience reporting from Iraq, what should reporters be watching most closely in covering Iraq?
Well, the issue that I think is the most undercovered issue right now is the prison population. There was a huge scandal 2 years ago when disgusting photos were released out of Abu Ghraib prison. And now the issue is for some reason gone away. But it hasn't gone away because there are no longer people being incarcerated without trial, without being allowed to see their lawyer in Abu Ghraib prison. There are 4,500 Iraqis arrested without trial in Abu Ghraib, and there are 15,000 Iraqis arrested without trial across the country. In fact, we are holding so many people in Abu Ghraib prison that we have had to build tents on the grounds of the prison because so many people have been arrested that they no longer fit in Saddam Hussein's old prison. And this is something that's never discussed in the media. You never hear the stories about innocent people incarcerated, which is a very common story, because the International Red Cross, which has access to the prisons, estimates 9 out of 10 people arrested by the U.S. military are arrested by mistake. And I've seen this in my own journalism, as the U.S. military will come to a neighborhood, sweep everyone on a particular street away, and take them to prison where they get no trial, so they have no hope of being released, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. And I would like to see more coverage of that, because I think it will help folks here understand why it is that there's so much resentment and violence towards U.S. troops by the Iraqi people.
We've been speaking with independent journalist Aaron Glantz. His new book is How America Lost Iraq. Aaron Glantz, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
The loudest anti-immigration voices in the media's current conversation, folks like Fox's Bill O'Reilly and CNN's Lou Dobbs, don't pride themselves on nuance. Dobbs has flatly declared that he's not interested in views that counter his own on the matter, and Bill O'Reilly is, well, Bill O'Reilly. But what about other more measured people who seem to concede that immigration, whatever its cultural and other benefits, is bad for U.S. workers, and especially those at the struggling end of things? Our next guest suggests that, while making no concession to the obvious irrationality driving so much of the argument, it can still be helpful to provide a factual response. And he does just that in the latest issue of Left Business Observer. Joining us now in studio to discuss the issue is Doug Henwood, editor and publisher of Left Business Observer, and host of the radio show Behind the News, heard like Counterspin on WBAI here in New York. Welcome back to Counterspin, Doug Henwood.
Always good to be here.
Well, it's not exactly absurd to believe that immigration might affect wages. There just isn't evidence to indicate that that's what's going on. Tell us about what economic research there is.
First of all, I think a lot of the opposition to immigration is really based at the level of fantasy and psychology. But for the people, the rational part of the population who want to hear something about facts, they are these. It's not an easy topic to study. It's hard for economists to study these things. But one thing you can do is look at what are called natural experiments. What happens when a large influx of immigrants suddenly hits a certain area? Several of these sorts of studies have been done. People who are repatriated from Algeria to France in the 1960s, the influx of Russians into Israel in the early 1990s, and the Mariel boatlift from Cuba into Miami in the early 1980s. And all of these studies have shown almost no impact on native employment or wages. Another thing that can be done is comparing cities or regions with high levels of immigrant workers to cities or regions with low level of immigrant workers. And when that is done, you also see almost no impact of the presence of immigrants on native wages or employment. So insofar as there's any economic evidence on this particular topic, that shows that there's quite a minimal impact.
You note in your piece that there's at least one high-profile researcher whose work seems to support the anti-immigration line. Can you tell us about the gentleman from Harvard?
Yeah, George Borjas is an interesting character. He came to the United States from Cuba in the 1960s and has devoted much of his recent research to demonstrating the allegedly malign impact of immigration on the United States. It's very interesting that an immigrant should come and want to so quickly shut the door behind him and devote his professional career to that task. But I think that's the way a lot of Americans are. You know, we're all a nation of immigrants, some who came here more willingly than others, but we all arrived here from somewhere else, and there's certainly an urge, almost as a rite of passage, as a part of becoming a citizen, to want to shut the door behind you. And Borjas argues that these sorts of studies I was citing earlier that show that there seems to be little impact on local labor markets of immigrants, he says that's the wrong level to look at, so he wants to look at the national level. But when he does that, he doesn't look at any other variables like unions or minimum wages or anything like that. He just finds an effect of immigrants. There's a lot of evidence in labor economics that there's been a tremendous increase in inequality, wage inequality over the last 25 years or so. And there are many, many reasons that have been given for this. There's trade, there's the decline of unions, there's a decline in minimum wage, this kind of winner-take-all premium that we see. There's the star system where big CEOs and athletes make so much more money than they used to. All these things have tremendous impact on the structure of wages and incomes. But Borjas doesn't look at any of this. He just looks at immigration and somehow manages to find an immigration effect. Now, if there were a big immigration effect, you would expect that the wage gap between people with less than a high school education and the rest of the labor force would be widening because most of the immigrants who come to the United States, at least the ones that people are concerned about, tend to have less than a high school education. And there is no such gap opening up. So even on the basis of that kind of national evidence, there's very little in the way of persuasive evidence that immigration has a big impact on native wages or employment.
This seems to me to be a big part of the discussion, that there are many other things that impact the economy and especially the lives of low-income workers more than immigration. And one wonders if these pundits, if their real concern was the lot of low-income people in this country, it seems like immigration would not be the first issue to go to.
Yeah, I think I'd love to see Bill O'Reilly do several shows on what's happened to unions, what the nature of American labor law is, what's happened to we haven't seen an increase in minimum wage in about 9 years. That's a very important influence on the low end of the labor market. We have a very weak welfare state, which provides no floor at all under wages. You know, we could look at all these kinds of impacts. We could look at trade and its impact on wages and employment, but they don't want to talk about that very much. They just want to talk about immigration. And I think partly it's always easy to blame foreigners, especially poor brown foreigners with not much in the way of a domestic political constituency. But also I think a lot of it is driven by anxiety about contamination. There's really a very heavily psychological dimension to this fear of immigrants, and it's really ugly and just makes my skin crawl to think about it.
Well, what about the frequently mentioned or alluded to drain on services, and specifically this line, it's not them, it's their children?
That's actually kind of interesting. First of all, the statistics on just how much immigrants cost the various treasuries, federal, state, and local, is kind of hard to come by. There are estimates floating around, even the ones you see from anti-immigrant forces like the Center for Immigration Studies. They say $10 billion in uncompensated hospital costs. You know, that's really nothing in an economy of $12 trillion like ours. We have a government budget of over $1 trillion, not including the state and local governments. And, you know, so $10 billion. In that context, is just pocket change, as ludicrous as that might sound. But that's also a very selective rendition of the evidence. Most undocumented workers contribute to Social Security, often under phony Social Security numbers, and then don't have a prayer of ever drawing benefits. So they're a net gain for the Social Security system. I think the Social Security Administration estimates that they have an income of about $8 billion they can't really account for. So, you know, that's a windfall. Over the longer term, we do need it would be very nice to have an influx of younger workers to help pay the Social Security checks of retirees like me when that comes to pass. So welcome an influx of younger workers. But the children of immigrants, it turns out, do very well. The studies we have of children of immigrants show that they actually perform as well as or slightly better than children of native-born parents on education and income. And so the second generation is, no matter how you slice the data, a net contributor to society, and I think that the first generation, too, is a net contributor to society, but there's no doubt about the second generation.
In the brief amount of time we have left, I just want to get your response to this that I've been thinking about. It seems likely that at least some of the people making what they would say is an economically grounded argument against immigration would at the same time say that they favored free trade and free markets. I wonder, is it coherent, really, to argue that capital should be mobile but not people?
Yeah, it really doesn't. It's not consistent. It doesn't make any sense, although I think, you know, the cultural or psychological antipathy to having foreigners living among us, I think, can explain a good bit of that contradiction. But me, you know, in my utopia, there would be no national borders and people would be free to move around as they like. And so I think, you know, we should try to make our immigration policy conform to that ideal as much as possible. We are all human beings and we're all part of one humanity, and we should try to make our policy reflect that rather than building walls along the border.
We've been speaking with Doug Henwood, editor and publisher of Left Business Observer. You can find them online at leftbusinessobserver.com. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call 1-800-847-3993, 1-800-847-3993. And be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's www.fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 26th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Republican leaders passed an Anwar oil drilling bill through the U.S. House Thursday. It's the 12th time the House has passed such a bill, this most recent one called the American-Made Energy and Good Jobs Act. The bill passed 225-201, but will most likely be filibustered in the Senate. Lucy Beach, executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee, says her group is committed to protecting the refuge and the porcupine caribou herd that the Gwich'in Athabascan depend on. She says Thursday's vote is no surprise, given the track record in the House.
You know, 12 times, if you keep trying the same thing over and over with the same results, isn't that the definition of insanity?
The Gwich'in Steering Committee has drawn worldwide attention to the Anwar drilling issue, as well as the porcupine caribou herd and the Gwich'in way of life since the 1980s. Beach says more people are opposed to drilling than what the Alaska delegation wants people to believe. She says supporters say they want to keep Anwar undeveloped, even if they never plan to visit.
Gwich'in called Ijik Watson Gwendai Gudlit the sacred place where life begins. At this time, the porcupine caribou herd is migrating to the calving and nursery grounds to have their calves. They calve about 40 to 50,000 calves in June, and there's birds from all 50 states and six continents that are winging their way there for nesting and staging. This place is unparalleled in diversity of any protected place in the circumpolar north.
The bill basically calls for oil and gas leasing in the 1.5 million acre coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, using new technologies and techniques to minimize the impact on the environment and wildlife. House Resources Committee Chairman Richard Pombo argued that since the area was designated for study in the 1980 Alaska Lands Act, oil extraction has evolved to the point that only a small portion of the acreage would be affected.
Technology obviously has advanced over the last 25 years, to the point today where the footprint has been reduced to the size of less than 2,000 acres.
Indeed, the bill includes a 2,000-acre limitation on the surface footprint of development, but California Democrat George Miller says it's meaningless.
This is about a pristine area that you either make a decision to industrialize or you don't. The 2,000-acre footprint is a hoax. There's another 69,000 acres under Indian jurisdiction. They can build airports. They can do whatever they want. That's the nature of our relationship with the Indian tribes. So the 2,000 acres is a hoax.
The Gwich'in Steering Committee's Lucy Beach also doesn't believe that promises for not harming the environment can be kept. She cited this year's oil spill in Prudhoe Bay and the Exxon Valdez as examples of unintentional devastation to pristine areas. This is Independent Native News with help from Tim Bodoni and Galena and Joel Southern in Washington, D.C. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.